Now I'll start. Okay.
Yeah, I started recording. And yeah, just to let everyone know who's listening eventually, the sacrifice and the Lord of Sa the Sacrifice on page 118, at least on this edition that I have, paragraph 20.
I don't know why you say paragraph 20, but I've counted mine and it seems to be 19. So.
Ah, okay. I counted one more, maybe. Yeah.
I just checked my count, and as far as
Yeah.
I can see, it's right. So.
Okay. So it's nine, probably 19. Yeah. I counted 20, 19, 20. It's one or the other. It's just there. So, okay. Well, because perhaps sometimes Sherbindo makes a little paragraph of one or two sentences. Sometimes I skip them. Or, yeah, okay. Doesn't matter. It's fine. So, should we begin with meditation?
Yep.
And then.
Jeffrey, I think you were first.
Sorry, I thought it was Marco.
I can also.
No, it's fine. I can do it. Okay. If a departure from the world and its activities, a supreme release and quietude were the sole aim of the seeker, the three great fundamental realizations would be sufficient for the fulfillment of his spiritual life. Concentrated in them alone, he could suffer all other divine or mundane knowledge to fall away from him, and himself unencumbered, depart into the eternal silence. But he has to take into account, of the world and its activities, learn what divine truth there may be behind them, and reconcile that apparent opposition between the divine truth and the manifest creation, which is the starting point of most spiritual experience. Here, on each line of approach that he can take, he is confronted with a constant duality, a separation between two terms of existence that seem to be opposites, and their opposition to be the very root of the riddle of the universe. Later, he may and does discover that these are the two poles of one being, connected by two simultaneous currents of energy, negative and positive, in relation to each other. Their interaction, the very condition for the manifestation of what is within the being, their reunion, the appointed means for the reconciliation of life's discords, and for the discovery of the integral truth of which he is the seeker.
For on one side, he is aware of his self everywhere, this everlasting spirit, substance, Brahman, the eternal, the same self-existence here in time behind each appearance he sees or senses, and timeless beyond the universe. He has this strong, overpowering experience of a self that is neither our limited ego nor our mind, life or body, worldwide, but not outwardly phenomenal, yet to some spirit sense in him more concrete than any form of phenomenon, universal yet not dependent for its being on anything in the universe or on the whole totality of the universe. If all this were to disappear, its extinction would make no difference to this eternal of his constant intimate experience. He is sure of an inexpressible self-existence, which is the essence of himself and all things. He is intimately aware of an essential consciousness of which thinking mind and life sense and body sense are only partial and diminished figures, a consciousness with an illimitable force in it, of which all energies are the outcome, but which is yet not explained or accounted for by the sum of power or nature of all these energies together. He feels he lives in an inalienable, self-existent bliss, which is not this lesser transient joy or happiness or pleasure. A changeless, imperishable infinity, a timeless eternity, a self-awareness which is not this receptive and reactive or tentacular mental consciousness, but is behind and above it and present to below it, and present to below it, even in what we call inconscience, a oneness in which there is no possibility of any other existence are the fourfold characters of this settled experience. Yet this eternal self-existence is seen by him also as a conscious time spirit bearing the stream of happenings, a self-extended spiritual space containing all things and beings, a spirit substance which is the very form and material of all that seems non-spiritual, temporary and finite. For all that is transitory, temporal, spatial, bounded, is yet felt by him to be in its substance and energy and power no other than the one, the eternal, the infinite.
And yet there is not only in him or before him this eternal self-aware existence, this spiritual consciousness, this infinity of self-illumined force, this timeless and endless beatitude. There is too, constant also to his experience, this universe in measurable space and time, some kind perhaps of boundless finite, and in it all is transient, limited, fragmentary, plural, ignorant, exposed to disharmony and suffering, seeking vaguely for some unrealized yet inherent harmony of oneness, unconscious or half-conscious, or even when most conscious, still tied to the original ignorance and inconscience. He is not always in a trance of peace or bliss. And even if he were, it would be no solution. For he knows that this would still be going on outside him, and yet within some larger self of him, as if forever. At times, these two states of his spirit seem to exist for him alternately according to his state of consciousness. At others, they are there as two parts of his being, disparate, and to be reconciled, two halves, an upper and a lower, or an inner and an outer half of his existence. He finds soon that the separation in his consciousness has an immense liberative power, for by it he is no longer bound to the ignorance, the inconscience. It no longer appears to him the very nature of himself and things, but an illusion which can be overcome, or at least a temporary wrong self-experience, Maya. It is tempting to regard it as only a contradiction of the divine, an incomprehensible mystery play, mask or travesty of the infinite. And so it irresistibly seems to his experience at times, on one side, the luminous verity of Brahman, on the other, a dark illusion of Maya. But something in him will not allow him to cut existence thus permanently in two. And looking more closely, he discovers that in this half light or darkness too is the eternal. It is the Brahman who is here with this face of Maya.
This is the beginning of a growing spiritual experience, which reveals to him more and more what seemed to him dark, incomprehensible Maya was all the time no other than the consciousness puissance of the eternal, timeless and illimitable beyond the universe, but spread out here under a mask of bright and dark opposites, for the miracle of the slow manifestation of the divine in mind and life and matter. All the timeless presses towards the play in time. All in time turns upon and around the timeless spirit. If the separative experience was liberative, This unitive experience is dynamic and effective. For he now not only feels himself to be in his soul substance, part of the eternal, in his essential self and spirit, entirely one with the eternal, but in his active nature, an instrumentation of its omniscience and omnipotent consciousness puissance. However bounded and relative its present play in him, he can open to a greater and greater consciousness and power of it. And to that expansion, there seems to be no assignable limit. A level spiritual and supramental of that consciousness puissance seems even to reveal itself above him and lean to enter into contact, where there are not these trammels and limits. And its powers too are pressing upon the play in time with the promise of a greater descent and a less disguised or no longer disguised manifestation of the eternal. The once conflicting, but now Bayun duality of Brahman Maya stands revealed to him as the first great dynamic aspect of the self of all selves, the master of existence, the lord of the world sacrifice, and of his sacrifice.
On another line of approach, another duality presents itself to the experience of the seeker. On one side, he becomes aware of a witness, recipient, observing, experiencing consciousness, which does not appear to act, but for which all these activities inside and outside us seem to be undertaken and continue. On the other side, he is aware at the same time of an executive force or an energy of process, which is seen to constitute, drive, and guide all conceivable activities, and to create a myriad forms visible to us and invisible, and use them as stable supports for its incessant flux of action and creation. Entering exclusively into the witness consciousness, he becomes silent, untouched, immobile. He sees that he has till now passively reflected and appropriated to himself the movements of nature. And it is by this reflection that they are acquired from the witness soul within him what seemed a spiritual value and significance. On that, he conscious only of himself from all this in motion around. All activities are outside in him, and at once they cease to be ultimately real. Here now, mechanical, detachable, endable. Entering exclusively into the kinetic movement, he has an opposite self-awareness. He seems to be his own perception of mass of activities, a formation and result of forces. If there is an active consciousness, even some kind of kinetic being in the midst of it all, yet there is no longer a free soul in it anywhere. These two different and opposite states of being alternate in him, or else stand simultaneously over against each other. One silent in the inner being observes, but is unmoved and does not participate. The other active in some outer or surface self, pursues its habitual movements. He has entered into an intense separative perception of the great duality, soul nature, Purusha Prakriti. So I'm just going to stop here because I'm trying to make sense of what's going on here. I think what I mean reading is the first duality is you know, darkness and light, if you like, the positive and the negative. The second duality is active and passive, or I don't know, something like that. Thoughts?
Yeah, I would say so.
So I
don't see this as contradictions. It's different aspects to see the same thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Andre.
So I don't know whether it was for everyone or just for me, but I had my sound, the sound of your voice, Jeffrey, was all broken up after the middle of the paragraph, the entering exclusively into the witness consciousness. So, and then I couldn't find where you were when I heard you again. I would be happy if that could be read again.
Okay.
Yeah, I can read it then.
Okay.
So, on another line of approach, another duality presents itself to the experiencer, to the experience of the seeker. On one side, he becomes aware of a witness recipient, observing, experiencing consciousness, which does not appear to act, but for which all these activities inside and outside us seem to be undertaken and continue. On the other side, he is aware at the same time of an executive force or an energy of process, which is seen to constitute, drive, and guide all conceivable activities, and to create a myriad forms visible to us and invisible, and use them as stable supports for its incessant flux of action and creation. Entering exclusively into the witness consciousness, he becomes silent, untouched, immobile. He sees that he has till now passively reflected and appropriated to himself the movements of nature, and it is by this reflection that they acquired from the witness soul within him what seemed a spiritual value and significance. But now he has withdrawn that ascription or mirroring identification, he is conscious only of his silent self and aloof from all that is in motion around it. All activities are outside him, and at once they cease to be intimately real. They appear now mechanical, detachable, endable. Entering exclusively into the kinetic movement, he has an opposite self-awareness. Entering exclusively into the kinetic movement, he has an opposite self-awareness. He seems to his own perception a mass of activities, a formation and result of forces. If there is an active consciousness, even some kind of kinetic being in the midst of it all, yet there is no longer a free soul in it anywhere. Anywhere. These two different and opposite states of being alternate in him, or else stand simultaneously over against each other. One silent in the inner being observes but is unmoved and does not participate. The other, active in some outer or surface self, pursues its habitual movements. He has entered into an intense separative perception of the great duality, soul nature, Purusha Prakriti.
But as the consciousness is, are we okay to continue? But as the consciousness deepens, he becomes aware that this is only a first frontal appearance. for he finds that it is by the silent support, permission, or sanction of this witness soul in him that this executive nature can work intimately or persistently upon his being. If the soul withdraws its sanction, the movement of nature in their action upon and within him become a wholly mechanical repetition, vehement at first as if seeking still to enforce their hold, but afterwards less and less dynamic and real. More actively using this power of sanction or refusal, he perceives that he can, slowly and uncertainly at first, more decisively afterwards, change the movements of nature. Eventually, in this witness soul, or behind it, is revealed to him the presence of a knower, a master will in nature, and all her activities more and more appear as an expression of what is known and either actively willed or passively permitted by this lord of her existence. Prakriti herself now seems to be mechanical only in the carefully regulated appearance of her workings, but in fact a conscious force with a soul within her, a self-aware significance in her turns, a revelation of a secret will and knowledge in her steps and figures. This duality, in aspect separate, is inseparable. Wherever there is Prakriti, there is Purusha. Wherever there is Purusha, there is Prakriti. Even in his inactivity, he holds in himself all her force and energies ready for projection. Even in the drive of her action, she carries with her all his observing and mandatory consciousness as the whole support and sense of her creative purpose. Once more, the seeker discovers in his experience the two poles of existence of one being and the two lines or currents of their energy, negative and positive, in relation to each other, which affect by their simultaneity, the manifestation of all that is within it. Here too he finds that the separative aspect is liberative, for it releases him from the bondage of identification with the inadequate workings of nature and the ignorance. The unitive aspect is dynamic and effective, for it enables him to arrive at mastery and perfection. While rejecting what is less divine or seemingly undivine in her, he can rebuild her forms and movements in himself according to a nobler pattern and the law and rhythm of a greater existence. At a certain spiritual and supramental level, the duality becomes still more perfectly two in one, the master soul with the conscious force within it, and its potentiality disowns all barriers and breaks through every limit. Thus, this once separate, now Bayun duality of Purusha Prakriti is revealed to him in all its truth as a second great instrumental and effective aspect of the soul of all souls, the master of existence, the lord of the sacrifice. I wouldn't mind a little a breath.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, especially this last paragraph reminds me of the discussions that I recently follow about the question of free will. And it has become a bit in fashion nowadays between scientists to those who speak about free will, they say we have or we have not free will. Sri Aurobindo gives a third possible answer to this here. He says we can if we have we are only the witness, everything is moves mechanically. It's a we see ourselves. I mean, the body, nature, our vital, our mind, everything is just as a mechanical movement of nature. But if you go a bit beyond that, you discover that it's not really that. That also there is a silent support, permission, or sanction of this witness soul can be there, and this changes the thing. So, do we have free will or not? This, it's a yes and no, at the same time, and that's what I find so powerful in Sri Aurobindo, because he never gives a binary answer to things. If you look things from one point of view, it's an answer. If you see it from another, but it's still another answer. But you can see a synthesis of this. And as far as I know, in all the discussions that we have now, nobody considers this option, that might be this third position. And that's what I found really very revealing. At any rate, what I'm not very clear about, that when he uses the word nature, I have my ideas about, but eventually I would like to hear also others what they think about, what you think about the word nature. Is not meant what we mean, just nature, trees, animals, forests. It's, I think, a much wider concept here. I don't know if Sri Aurobindo has ever defined that or distinguished it. He speaks about nature. I think if someone does not know what it means, it can be pretty confusing here. But well, these were more comments than questions. That is also a question, if someone has an idea. Otherwise, go ahead.
I have a glossary here.
Ah. Great.
Glossary of terms in Sri Aurobindo's writing. Nature.
Yeah.
An active force of conscious being, which realizes itself in its powers of self-experience, its powers of knowledge, will, self-delight, self-formation, with all their marvelous variations, inversions, conservations, and conversions of energy, even perversions, is what we call prakriti, or nature, in ourselves as in the cosmos. All nature is simply the seer will, the knowledge force of the conscious being at work to evolve in force and form all the inevitable idea, all the inevitable truth of the idea into which it has originally thrown itself. And there's more, but that's better.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, John Robert. Yeah, this only that would need, I think, a whole session to be clarified. But I think it gives some hint. Yeah, an active force of conscious being. Yeah.
Yeah. For so this, when we talk about nature, we think about it as separate from us. So there's nature, exactly, and there's humanity.
Yeah.
This doesn't separate us from it. We're part of nature, and we're part of,
exactly.
I mean, we have both nature and our soul, yeah, and nature, Purusha and Prakriti. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So for this question of free will, one of the recent readings I did this year was in Omar Khayyam. And Khayyam, so this is, 11th century philosopher writer, and Khayyam has this fascinating idea about free will. He suggests that the world is divided into two kinds of things that are necessary and things that are accidental. And the necessary things for him have to do, the closer you get to the divine, the more necessary they get. And the further away from the divine you get, the more accidental things become.
Yeah.
So that the world that we deal with on the everyday tends to be largely accidental. And then as you work closer to the divine, you get closer to these ideas, you know, which is very close in some ways to Aurobindo's ideas. But I find this sort of clarity between the accidental and the necessary very interesting in Khayyam. And you can see it in, you know, so the poetry verses, the quatrains that he's so famous for, are largely about the accidental world. You know, so the sort of potter and the vases that the potter makes, and this sort of understanding of the world in terms of death and difficulty and accident. And a lot of the poetry that he writes is about, part of the poetry that was in Edward Fitzgerald translation of his poetry. But the problem is that Fitzgerald was himself an atheist, violently against religion. And so he selected out of Khayyam's writings only those texts that expressed the accidentality and left to one side from the texts of Khayyam, the ones that dealt with the necessity. So the Rubaiyat that people know today are a subset of his poetry and misses all the stuff dealing with the more divine aspects of the world. So anyway, it's interesting.
Yeah. The question would also be if this notion of accidentality, something that is accidental, is there anything that is really accidental, or is it also that just a matter of perspective? Yeah. So this is...
Well, he was pretty quantic,
I was not thinking about quantum mechanics here. I was just thinking that what appears to us accidental in hindsight, you see that in your life may have taught something, and then you say, okay, it served a purpose perhaps.
So if I look at that from what I learned from Sri Aurobindo, is that maybe it refers to levels of consciousness, that in the material world, in our activities, there is a, you know, the less conscious, the more automatic we are in our actions, the less thoughtful, right? More unconscious. But still, even the unconscious is part of her. And so even there, she moves. Anyway.
I think a nice parallel to what Jeffrey was talking about, necessary and accidental, is unity and fragmentation. So the divine is the one. And as you move down the scale of consciousness, like Andrea was talking about, you get more into fragmentation and separation. And one of the prime features of ego is that it's fragmented, it's separated from everything else. So the whole world, the ego is arrayed against the whole world. It's I'm myself, and I'm not you, and I'm not this rock, and I'm not the tree, and I'm not the sky, I'm not any of those things, I'm just me. And so you have this rather exaggerated separation in viewpoint. And then when that I becomes more identified with the unity with nature and with what we call nature and with the soul and with the divine, the fragmentation gradually disappears. But it remains a movement. So somebody who's an experienced yogi could move from the perception of total unity to the perception of fragmentation and back.
Yeah, I think this is also good parallel. Should I continue? Andrea is gone. Okay. So this was paragraph 25. On yet another line of approach.
Marco, it's my turn.
It's your turn. I thought the last was Jeffrey, but okay, sorry.
No, Andrea read the last bit.
Okay.
On yet another line of approach, the seeker meets another corresponding, but an aspect distinct duality, in which the Bayun character is more immediately apparent. The dynamic duality of Ishvara Shakti. On one side, he is aware of an infinite and self-existent Godhead in being who contains all things in an ineffable potentiality of existence. A self of all selves, a soul of all souls, a spiritual substance of all substances, an impersonal, inexpressible existence. But at the same time, an illimitable person who is here self-represented in numerous personality, in numberless personality, a master of knowledge, a master of forces, a lord of love and bliss and beauty, a single origin of the worlds, a self-manifester and self-creator, a cosmic spirit, a universal mind, a universal life. The conscious and living reality supporting the appearance of which we sense as supporting the appearance which we sense as unconscious, inanimate matter. On the other side, he becomes aware of the same Godhead in effectuating consciousness and power put forth as a self-aware force that contains and carries all within her and is charged to manifest it in universal time and space. It is evident to him that here there is one supreme and infinite being represented to us in two different sides of itself, obverse and reverse in relation to each other. All is either prepared or preexistent in the Godhead in being and issues from it and is upheld by its will and presence. All is brought out, carried in movement by the Godhead in power. All becomes and acts and develops by her and in her its individual or its cosmic purpose. It is again a duality necessary for the manifestation, creating and enabling that double current of energy, which seems always necessary for the world workings, two poles of the same being, but here closer to each other and always very evidently carrying each the powers of the other in its essence and its dynamic nature. At the same time, by the fact that two great elements of the divine mystery, the personal and the impersonal, are here fused together, the seeker of the integral truth feels in the duality of Ishvara Shakti his closeness to a more intimate and ultimate secret of the divine transcendence and the manifestation than that offered to him by any other experience.
For the Ishvara Shakti, divine conscious force and world mother, becomes a mediatrix between the eternal one and the manifested many. On one side, by the play of the energies which she brings from the one, she manifests the multiple divine in the universe, involving and evolving its endless appearances out of her revealing substance. On the other, by the reascending current of the same energies, she leads back all towards that from which they have issued, so that the soul in its evolutionary manifestation may more and more return towards the divinity there or here put on its divine character. There is not in her, although she devises a cosmic mechanism, the character of an inconscient mechanical executrix, which we find in the first physiognomy of Prakriti, the nature force. Neither is there that sense of an unreality, creatrix of illusions or semi-illusions, which is attached to our first view of Maya. It is at once clear to the experiencing soul that here is a conscious power of one substance and nature, which the Supreme from whom she, with the Supreme from whom she came. If she seems to have plunged us into the ignorance and inconscience in pursuance of a plan we cannot yet interpret, if her forces present themselves as all these ambiguous forces of the universe, yet it becomes visible before long that she is working for the development of the divine consciousness in us, and that she stands above, drawing us to her own higher entity, revealing to us more and more the very essence of the divine knowledge, will and ananda. Even in the movements of the ignorance, the soul of the seeker becomes aware of her conscious guidance, supporting his steps and leading them slowly or swiftly, straight or by many detours, out of the darkness into the light of a greater consciousness, out of mortality into immortality, out of evil and suffering towards our highest good and felicity, of which as yet his human mind can form only a faint image. Thus her power is at once liberative and dynamic, creative, effective. Creative not only of things as they are, but of things that are to be. For eliminating the twisted and tangled movements of his lower consciousness, made of the stuff of ignorance, it rebuilds and new makes his soul and nature into the substance and forces of a higher divine nature.
In this duality too, there is possible a separative experience. At one pole of it, the seeker may be conscious only of the master of existence, putting forth on him his energies of knowledge, power, and bliss to liberate and divinize. The Shakti may appear to him only an impersonal force expressive of these things or an attribute of the Ishvara. At the other pole, he may encounter the World Mother, creatrix of the universe, putting forth the gods and the worlds and all things and existence out of her spirit substance. Or even if he sees both aspects, it may be with an unequal separating vision, subordinating one to the other, regarding the Shakti only as a means for approaching the Ishvara. There results a one-sided tendency or a lack of balance, a power of effectuation not perfectly supported, or a light of revelation not perfectly dynamic. It is when a complete union of the two sides of the duality is effected and rules his consciousness that he begins to open to a fuller power that will draw him altogether out of the confused clash of ideas and forces here into a higher truth and enable the descent of that truth to illumine and deliver and act sovereignly upon this world of ignorance. He has begun to lay his hand on the integral secret which in its fullness can be grasped grasped only when he overpasses the double term that reigns here of knowledge inextricably intertwined with an original ignorance and crosses the border where spiritual mind disappears into supramental gnosis. It is through this third and most dynamic dual aspect of the One that the seeker begins with the most integral completeness to enter into the deepest secret of the being of the Lord of the Sacrifice. Well, I must say, I lost a bit. Here is another duality. He distinguishes from the other, for the dualities we spoke previously, for the witness and prakriti nature, the witness and the self. Here is the Shakti and Ishvara. And the world mother on the other. So which one pole is the master of existence, putting force on himself, energies of self-knowledge. Can someone make a summary?
I'm seeing the two as so in that same sentence that you started to read, and it goes to the Shakti may appear to him only an impersonal force expressive of these things, or an attribute of the Ishvara. And at the other side, he may encounter the world mother, creatrix of the universe, putting forth the gods and the worlds. So there he's looking at the two aspects of here of the mother, it seems.
So one is, it is the duality between impersonality and personality.
Or between mechanical and organic, or creative in the organic sense, I think.
I think the basic distinction here is between the Lord, Ishvara, and Shakti, who is the mother. And then he talks about different ways of experiencing those two, that duality, including where it comes together into unity. So if this is a third duality we've been reading about in this chapter, and the first one was Brahman and Maya, and the second one was soul and nature, or Purusha and Prakriti, and the third one here is Ishvara and Shakti, or Ishvara and Ishwari. So in the last paragraph, let's see, I think it's the last paragraph. I think it's at the bottom of page 124 in my version. He talks about the Ishwari Shakti. So that's the mother. So Ishwara is the Lord, and Ishwari is the Shakti, or the divine mother. So he's giving us these three different kinds of duality that we may encounter as we become more conscious, and talking about how they have this separative value, and then how also they can come together into unity and enlargement.
Yeah. So is he speaking now of the same thing seen from different aspects, or are these three things different? Because Brahman, Maya, Purusha, Prakriti, Ishvara, Shakti, are these just words, different words to express the same thing, or different words to express three different things? That's a question. I'm not sure about it. For me, from the description, I would say these are three ways to describe the same duality, but I would not bet on that.
Well, it's like, it's Vedic, right? So
yeah.
It's like the Vedas, where he sees the Vedic gods as different aspects of the soul, the being, whatever. And so I think that there are different aspects of the dynamics of what's going on, right?
Another way to look at it is to say these are coming from different philosophical schools in philosophy. So Purusha Prakriti comes from the Sankhya school, and Sri Aurobindo adopted it to fit his own metaphysics, his own understanding of the spirit world. And Brahman Maya, that's Vedantic, I think. So you have the God, the one God or the supreme God. And Maya originally, according to Sri Aurobindo, was actually the creative power. And it, over the course of evolution and Indian spiritual philosophy, it became separated and became identified with the illusion. So the creative work that Maya does was considered illusion, and only Brahman was real. Only Brahman was the one.
Right.
And I don't know what the origin of Ishwara Shakti is in terms of Indian spiritual philosophy, but I think you can look at it upon as different levels of consciousness that enable you to look at things. So if you're in a very high metaphysical consciousness, you can look at Brahman and Maya, and at a lower, more individual consciousness, the witness soul and nature. And this Ishwara Shakti, I think, is in between those, more of a cosmic power, more cosmic powers. But they're just the levels, just different ways of looking at the manifestation and the transcendence.
Perhaps we can say that Ishvara Shakti is a tantric point of view.
Yeah, I don't know. It could be.
Purusha Prakriti is a Sankhya, and Brahman Maya, the Vedic, the Vedantic.
I bet you're right, because the Shakti has a really important role in the tantric world. Huh?
Mm. Yeah. I still need categorizations. I hope I will go beyond that, but perhaps this gives a better idea now. What's that about? Yeah. Thank you.
The mind tries.
Yeah.
We are mental beings, so yeah, we use that and hope it widens as we read this kind of thing.
It's okay, right, go on. For it is behind the mystery of the presence of personality in an apparently impersonal universe, as in that of consciousness manifesting out of the inconscient, life out of the inanimate, soul out of brute matter, that is hidden the solution of the riddle of existence. For it is behind the mystery of the presence of personality in an apparently impersonal universe, as in that of consciousness manifesting out of the inconscient, life out of the inanimate, soul out of brute matter, that is hidden the solution of the riddle of existence. Here again is another dynamic duality, more pervading than appears at first view, and deeply necessary to the play of the slowly revealing self-revealing power. It is possible for the seeker in his spiritual experience, standing at one pole of the duality, to follow mind in seeing a fundamental impersonality everywhere. The evolving soul in the material world begins from a vast impersonal inconscience in which our inner sight yet perceives the presence of a veiled infinite spirit. It proceeds with the emergence of a precarious consciousness and personality that even at their fullest have the look of an episode, but an episode that repeats itself in constant series. It arises through experience of life out of mind into an infinite, impersonal and absolute superconscious, in which personality, mind consciousness, life consciousness seem all to disappear by a liberating annihilation, nirvana. At a low pitch, he still experiences this fundamental impersonality as an immense liberating force everywhere. It releases his knowledge from the narrowness of personal mind, his will from the clutch of personal desire, his heart from the bondage of petty, mutable emotions, his life from its petty personal groove, his soul from ego, and it allows them to embrace calm, equality, wideness, universality, infinity. A yoga of works would seem to require personality as its mainstay, almost its source. But here too, the impersonal is found to be the most direct liberating force. It is through a wide, egoless impersonality that one can become a free worker and a divine creator. It is not surprising that the overwhelming power of this experience from the impersonal pole of the duality should have moved the sages to declare this to be the one way and an impersonal superconscious conscience to be the sole truth of the eternal.
But still, to the seeker standing at the opposite pole of the duality, another line of experience appears which justifies an intuition deeply seated behind the heart and in our very life force, that personality, like consciousness, life, soul, is not a brief-lived stranger in an impersonal eternity, but contains the very meaning of existence. This fine flower of the cosmic energy carries in it a forecast of the aim and a hint of the very motive of the universal labor. As an occult vision opens in him, he becomes aware of worlds behind in which consciousness and personality hold an enormous place and assume a premier value. Even here in the material world, to this occult vision, the inconscience of matter fills with a secret, pervading consciousness. Its inanimation harbors a vibrant life. Its mechanism is the device of an indwelling intelligence. God and soul are everywhere. Above all stands an infinite conscious being who is variously self-expressed in all these worlds. Impersonality is only a first means of that expression. It is a field of principles and forces, an equal basis of manifestation. But these forces express themselves through beings, have conscious spirits at their head, and are the emanation of a one conscious being who is their source. A multiple, innumerable personality expressing that one is the very sense and central aim of the manifestation. And if now personality seems to be narrow, fragmentary, restrictive, it is only because it has not opened to its source or flowered into its own divine truth and fullness, packing itself with the universal and the infinite. Thus, the world creation is no more an illusion, a fortuitous mechanism, a play that need not to have happened, a flux without consequence. It is an intimate dynamism of the conscious and living eternal.
This extreme opposition of view from the two poles of one existence creates no fundamental difficulty for the seeker of the integral yoga, for his whole experience has shown him the necessity of these double terms and their currents of energy, negative and positive in relation to each other, for the manifestation of what is within the one existence. For himself, personality and impersonality have become the two wings of his spiritual ascension, and he has the prevision that he will reach a height where their helpful interaction will pass into a fusion of their powers and disclose the integral reality and release into action the original force of the divine, not only in the fundamental aspects, but in all the workings of his sadhana. He has felt their double truth and mutually complementary working. An impersonal presence has dominated from above or penetrated and occupied his nature. A light descending has diffused his mind, life power, the very cells of his body, illumined them with knowledge, revealed him to himself down to his most disguised and unsuspected movements, exposing, purifying, destroying, or brilliantly changing all that belonged to the ignorance. A force has poured into him in currents or like a sea, working in his being and all its members, dissolved, new made, reshaped, transfigured everywhere. A bliss has invaded him and shown that it can make suffering and sorrow impossible and turn pain itself into divine pleasure. A love without limits has joined him to all creatures, or revealed to him a world of inseparable intimacy and unspeakable sweetness and beauty, and begun to impose its law of perfection and its ecstasy even among the disharmony of terrestrial life. A spiritual truth and right have convicted the good and evil of this world of imperfection or of falsehood, and unveiled the supreme good and its clue of subtle harmony and its sublimation of action and feeling and knowledge. But behind all these things and in them, he has felt a divinity who is all these things, a bringer of light, a guide and all-knower, a master of force, a giver of bliss, friend, helper, father, mother, playmate in the world game, an absolute master of his being, his soul's beloved and lover. All relations known to human personality are there in the soul's contact with the divine, but they rise towards superhuman levels and compel him towards a divine nature.
It is an integral knowledge that is being sought, and integral force, a total amplitude of union with the all and infinite behind existence. For the seeker of the integral yoga, no single experience, no one divine aspect, however overwhelming to the human mind, sufficient for its capacity, easily accepted as the soul or the ultimate reality, can figure as the exclusive truths of the eternal. For him, the experience of the divine oneness carried to its extreme is more deeply embraced and amply fathomed by following out to the full the experience of the divine multiplicity. All that is true behind polytheism as well as behind monotheism falls within the scope of his seeking. But he passes beyond their superficial sense to human mind to grasp their mystic truths in the divine. He sees what is aimed at by the jarring sects and philosophies and accepts each facet of the reality in its own place, but rejects their narrowness and errors and proceeds farther till he discovers the one truth that binds them together. The reproach of anthropomorphism and anthropolatry, I can't even try to read it, there's an error, typing, the reproach of anthropomorphism and anthropolatry, thank you, John Robert. So again, the reproach of anthropomorphism and anthropolatry cannot deter him, for he sees them to be prejudices of the ignorant and arrogant reasoning intelligence, the abstracting mind turning on itself in its own cramped circle. If human relations, as practiced now by man, are full of small, smallness and perversity and ignorance, yet are they disfigured shadows of something in the divine. And by turning them to the divine, he finds that of which they are a shadow and brings it down for manifestation and life. It is through the human exceeding itself and opening itself to a supreme plenitude that the divine must manifest itself there, since that comes inevitably in the course and process of the spiritual evolution, and therefore he will not despise or blind himself to the Godhead because it is lodged in a human body. Manu sim tanum asritam. Beyond the limited human conception of God, he will pass to the one divine eternal, but also he will meet him in the faces of the gods, his cosmic personalities supporting the world play. Detect him behind the mask of the vibhutis, embodied world forces of human leaders. Reverence and obey him in the guru, worship him in the avatar. This will be to him his exceeding good fortune if he can meet one who has realized or is becoming that which he seeks for and can by opening to it in this vessel or its manifestation, himself realize it. I realize last sentence again. This will be to him his exceeding good fortune if he can meet one who has realized or is becoming that which he seeks for and can by opening to it in this vessel of its manifestation himself realize it. For that is the most palpable sign of the growing fulfillment, the promise of the great mystery of the progressive descent into matter, which is the secret sense of the material creation and the justification of terrestrial existence.
Thus reveals himself to the seeker in the progress of the sacrifice, the Lord of the sacrifice. At any point, this revelation can begin. In any aspect, the master of the work can take up the work in him and more press upon him and it for the unfolding of his presence. In time, all the aspects disclose themselves, separate, combine, fuse, are unified together. At the end, there shines through it all the supreme integral reality, unknowable to mind, which is part of the ignorance, but knowable because self-aware in the light of a spiritual consciousness and a supramental knowledge. I would appreciate for us to end here. There seems to be a break in the chapter.
I agree, I'm kind of saturated.
Yeah, saturated indeed.
Yeah. Okay.
We only have a couple of pages left. Maybe when we finish it next time, maybe we can read this chapter again.
Yeah. I think so.
It'll be quite the something.
It's heavy stuff. Okay,
we have a little meditation.
Little meditation. See you next time. Namaste.
Namaste.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This is lovely reading.
Is it?
Yeah, so wonderful. Thank you.
Powerful also.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.